Have you heard the tale of Robbie the Rebel? Not to be confused with Robbie the Robot from Lost in Space or Robbie Rebel, an effort by that British comic strip, The Beano, to create a Dennis the Menace of the 21st century. Let us not bathe in the broth of cheap nostalgia, for that is the dewy existential placenta of an overgrown child in her 30s with a Tumblr account and too much spare time. I only bring up these pop cultural antecedents to inure myself from charges that Robbie the Rebel, which sprang this week from the frosty forehead of my fluctuating and imperfect imagination, was in some sense a knockoff, a cheap, hacky throwaway to be inserted into the dregs of this fragile radio operation. Anyway, Robbie the Rebel. We all know him to some degree. One last exiguous belch from the 20th century. But let's establish a template. Robbie the Rebel. He was given a cassette tape in his teenage years by a friend who cared, and he blasted loud, iconoclastic music to find meaning inside the porous lie of an apparent suburban dream. A dim, slim shadow of Eisenhower affluence when the top tax rate was properly medicated. The man on the tape shrieked sweet somethings into his ear about the broken pact of post-Johnson America, the crackdown on souls who told the truth, the flood of crack into poor hoods, the rise of guns and liquor stores, of which he had had some first-hand experience. And Robbie, not yet a rebel, tuned into all this apparent noise. He was learning he needed to drown out the shouts of parents arguing over money problems, the heavy ledgers hidden inside the closet, exposing the folly of their middle-class fantasies, revealing how income coming in never quite matched the expenses, pouring out like some cheap keg the teenagers had left running into Sunday morning. His parents had flown too close to the flashy fire of snazzy materialism, and these selfish desires for a quick fix were better than a bottle of Hennessy passed among pals under an interstate overpass. So Robbie rebelled. It started with small gestures, coming home after curfew, refusing to do his chores, surrendering assigned duties for the self-made actualizations exploding in his mind, using the stereo's volume knob to reflect, perhaps modulate, the truth of his turmoil. And when his parents attempted meager measures of discipline, Robbie retrieved the Louisville Slugger his grandfather had given him a decade before, the bat that could not secure this little league sinecure that all had hoped for, and he began swinging it at the cheap giant, the fragile television set, the frangible credenza gathering dust in the spare room. Therapists interceded, but they were no match against Robbie's ire. Perhaps Robbie's behavior would have been accepted or understood if he had not resorted to violence. Perhaps if Robbie had worn a clown nose or a paisley kilt or an idiosyncratic floret on the lapel of a sports coat he could never afford in his wildest dreams, Robbie's behavior would have been accepted as an eccentric show for attention. Something manageable or assuaged or even medicated over time. But Robbie was dead serious. As far as he was concerned, the system had failed him and he needed to resist. He left home before they could dope him up or put him away or take all the sting from the buzz of his natural tail. Robbie the Rebel would not be placated. He dyed his hair bright blue and met a young woman named Miriam, whose hair glowed green, and they began living with each other. And Robbie and Miriam handed out flyers, countless flyers, in the streets, telling all who would listen about how 99% of American citizens were slaves to an imperious and impetuous elite. This civil engagement was largely ignored, but you see, the law allowed this literature to be disseminated, and the law had to be respected. Unfortunately, society had erected a safeguard, a social code so intuitive that you didn't even have to teach it. It didn't even have to be talked about. Ignore anyone with a wild or passionate look in her eyes. And if you must tolerate them, let them speak at the top of their lungs. Let their audiences remain deaf and docile. Eventually, oh, these rebels would go away. They would go away. They would grow up. They wouldn't be in your hair ever again. But Robbie the Rebel and Miriam, his green-haired partner in crime, carried on. They attracted a handful of associates, mostly their age, but all of them dyeing their hair with the available tints of the rainbow, not seeing that their rebellious spirit had reached a certain follicular baseline. Robbie the Rebel wanted to step things up. He really wanted to stick it to the man, but Miriam, his green-haired partner in crime, told Robbie that she was with child, and she soon stopped dyeing her hair and no longer wished to participate in Robbie's activities. There was, after all, a new life to prepare for.
"But what of the social injustices?" said Robbie. "What of war and poverty and income inequality and slavery and..."
"What of our child?"
"Our child will live in that future. We must do everything we can to counter it."
There were many conversations like this between Robbie the Rebel and Miriam, and their rebellious associates soon grew tired of this square banter. It would go on to grow elsewhere, leaving Robbie and Miriam to their colloquies. Robbie would not surrender his rebellious nature. He would not find a job, much as Miriam had. He could not find a job because he had moved directly from his parents' home to these decidedly unlucrative activities in the street. And the world would never know just what he sacrificed for his rebellion. And since his rebellion had failed, and since society only encouraged the successful efforts, Robbie the Rebel became lost and punished and hidden, and unloved. And, dear listeners, there is no real way that I can sugarcoat this woeful tale. We all know a Robbie the Rebel to some degree, and it happens far more frequently than we could possibly know. And we don't give Robbie the Rebel the time of day. But I'm here to tell you this. Robbie the Rebel doesn't have to be forgotten. The Rebel. You'd think that a culture that gave us John Brown, Margaret Sanger, and Rosa Parks would be more encouraging of this proud American tradition. This week, we examine why rebels get the short end of the stick. We talk with historian Jean Theo Harris about how Rosa Parks' rebellious life has been swept under the carpet of modern American history. We examine Pussy Riot's rebellious legacy with many of the band's supporters, and chat with a rebel journalist about a mysterious shooting in Missouri and the pros and cons of assumption. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears. Episode 5, Rebels.
What's your name?
Joe.
Joe, so I'm asking people this. What's the most rebellious thing you've ever done?
Most rebellious thing I've ever done? Anything my mother told me not to do.
Oh. Specific or anything?
Rebellious thing I've ever done? Most rebellious thing I've ever done when I was 16, I got a tattoo.
A tattoo?
when I was 16 years old.
Wow. What does the tattoo say?
It just says my Joe. Say my name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that was about, that's pretty much it.
You were very literal in your rebellion.
Yeah. When I was younger. But that's about the most rebellious thing I've ever done.
Honestly, nothing.
Nothing?
No.
Not rebelled in any way?
No. Not at all.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I like keeping my distance from rebellious things.
Probably cursed out my parents.
I'm not a rebellious person.
Really?
I'm a follower. Yeah, I'm risk averse.
Oh.
I'm a tax lawyer.
So why do you think you're risk averse? Just your nature?
Just my nature. Just my nature. Yeah. I have three kids and they're really risk averse too. They're like,
oh, it's genetic.
16, 13. Yeah, I married a tax lawyer too.
He's risk averse as well.
Yeah. I don't know. Sorry. I'm not making your radio show.
This is all interesting. Have you ever been tempted to rebel? Or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure.
What keeps you back?
I'm always thinking about the future. That's how lawyers think.
Just the most rebellious thing I've done.
Your parents don't know you're in New York.
Well, there you go. Parents don't know I'm in New York.
You're rebelling right now.
Yeah, I am rebelling right now. They think I'm in Belgium, but I'm in New York.
Probably sneak out in the middle of the night, come back home 5 a.m, sneak back into bed while my parents are still sleeping.
Yeah,
I guess that's the only thing I can remember right now.
When I was about 14, I tried to sneak a boy in my room through the window.
That's as rebel as you got.
I think so.
You tried. Was this a successful operation?
No, it did not work at all.
Did you get caught by your dad?
Epic fail.
Surfing here in New York City in Rockaways.
Oh, yeah?
On the winter of 2004, it was pretty cold out there, yeah. It was snow on the sand. Pretty cold inside. That was the most rebellious thing I feel like ever done. 16 degrees Fahrenheit, yeah.
So what were you rebelling against? You were rebelling against the weather, the expectations?
I was rebelling against the whole news about not getting into the water because it was dangerous, and I just did it, and it came out really nice, yeah. It was pretty nice.
Married my husband that I met on holiday, I think.
Ah, wow.
Oh, I'm not a rebel.
Oh.
I'm not a rebel, I'm a good girl.
Oh, I think when I was like 8, I stole a box of cigarettes and went and smoked them when I was 8. That's very rebellious, isn't it?
Yeah, very rebellious.
Yeah.
Oh, how about you? You guys have the beat there?
I've not done anything rebellious in my life. I'm just a...
You stick
absolutely
with her for
clean. Yeah,
yeah,
completely.
I'm his wild side.
Fantastic. The most rebellious... I don't know. I have done a lot of rebellious things in my world. I did stand up at a corporate Christmas party once and tell my boss, fuck you, I quit. How's that for rebellion? That's pretty good. That may not be the most rebellious. You're a rebellious guy by nature? I've conformed a little bit, but yes, I probably was a rebel without a clue. You can't quite tame the rebel impulse. No, I can't tame it. You know, I'm still a rebel to a degree today.
For what it's worth, I didn't actively seek out people from the United Kingdom as I wandered around Times Square for the last segment, but I found it quite intriguing that people from the UK were more likely to talk about rebellious hacks than their American counterparts. And this left me wondering, where did all the rebels go? Why are they becoming more difficult to find in America? I decided to talk with Frances Madison. Frances is the author of the novel Cooperative Village. She left New York in 2010 and moved to Farmington, Missouri, a small town with a population of 16,000. Not long after she arrived in Farmington, she became editor and publisher of the Madison County Crier, a biweekly newspaper distributed in the area.
So let's talk about your stint at the Madison County Crier. You and Karen Whitener initially hit it off, and you seem to believe that journalism involved telling people what is actually going on. What happened here?
Ed, I would hardly call it a stint. And you know, I'm really not a journalist at all. I'm a literary artist. I'm a novelist. You know, I'm into composition. And, you know, my friends here in the town that I live in said that Fredericktown was going to run me out of town on a rail in 10 issues, but it only took 7.
So, you exceeded their expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I knew what I was getting into, and I wanted to have it be a true exploration and have it be grounded in everyone's actual experiences of the newspaper. And so I came on, you know, very strong. Issue 1, there was a both an interview with the newly elected mayor which is fascinating because, you know, she reveals that, you know, the Lord brought her to her position as mayor of Fredericktown, population 4,000. Issue one, I had this incredible tour with the mayor where she really pointed out like the pockmarks where they don't have lights, you know, basic fundamental infrastructure stuff. But the most important thing I did in issue one, and the thing I kind of came to Missouri to do, I think, in retrospect, of course, you know, we only decide these things after we see what the hell we've done. I printed the Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Ben Bernanke's speech on community banking in its entirety in my free alternative community newspaper. Why did I do that, Ed? Because I have the requisite skills to read between the lines of those words and to see the viciousness that is embedded therein. And I just wanted to see if the people there were paying attention to something so fundamental. I mean, try living in capitalism without capital. Go ahead, try it. You know, that's not going to fly. So I went to the bankers, the local trusted community bankers, and I asked them to weigh in with commentary and analysis in issue two. And Ed, they did.
Yes. Well, that's journalism. I mean, that's not necessarily literary artistry. That's trying to get multiple perspectives talking about an issue and putting them into a place where a community can read it. What went wrong here, Francis?
People knew that I was there to rock the boat by that time. And what was happening is that we were kind of gaining more advertisers, but not more advertising dollars. And I would get an advertiser and I would lose an advertiser. And I could see that the town was never going to let me flourish. They were always going to be keeping me in check with this kind of dollars game. And I also got wind that certain people had been confronting my advertisers as early as issue three. There was a lot of lava building up in this volcano. And as you know, Michael Miner, very seasoned media columnist in the Chicago Reader, wrote about what ultimately happened. And he very pithily termed it the seizure of Fredericktown. And I really don't think that was hyperbolic. I really think that's what happened.
So you just told me that you were actually gaining advertisers during the first three issues. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So you actually were attracting advertisers because of the different shift in tone here.
Many people were very excited about this new iteration of the Madison County Crier. You know, in addition to being the publisher and the editor and, you know, the backbone of the writing staff, if I may pat myself on the back, I mean, this was all kind of not just cushioned, but, you know, integrated in all these other community voices.
If you had a readership in place, an enthusiastic readership, my question for you is, why didn't you use that readership to mobilize against these people who were trying to tear your operation down, who were trying to tell the advertisers that they should not actually advertise in the Madison County Crier, that they should just go ahead and let this newspaper plummet? I mean, it seems to me that if you have a great readership, you can mobilize them and get them to put pressure on businesses who don't understand the mission of your operation. So I have to ask.
Eddie, you're talking like a New Yorker, sweetheart. You're talking like an urbane, sophisticated, educated man who is empowered. You're talking like someone who is not held down by dynastic families, decades of established hierarchy, winners and losers, already carved out, a social schema within, there's very little mobility. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different mindset. What I was trying to do was give them the opportunity to confront the choice of mobilizing or not.
In recent months, Frances has devoted her time to letting people know about Callion Hamblin, a 32-year-old man on the run from police and bounty hunters and shot by the Farmington police on February 20th, 2012. I had made assumptions earlier about Francis's town, but when I asked Francis to elaborate on the details of Callion Hamblin, I discovered that Francis began making assumptions of her own.
I didn't understand that when I came to Missouri, I was coming to kind of pop my own bubble and get a fuller, more comprehensive and in-depth understanding of the country that we're living in and the police state that we're living in. So, you know,
why do you assume that it's automatically a police state? Why do Hamblin's friends and family feel that this was an execution?
Well, you're getting right down to it, aren't you? Ed, I want to tell you something. This is knowledge that was arrived at collectively. This was a process of telling each other the story in meetings that we've been having over and over, and each time more and more pieces of the story being voiced, and me listening and me taking notes and me, you know, kind of discerning, and me with my narrative gifts, seeing the connections, asking the next question that's going to draw, you know, intuitively groping. And the story got heavier and heavier and heavier the more pieces we put on the table. And so, like, at first, like the first time we went through the story, we didn't tell each other about the ambulance. You know, the fact that that ambulance was waiting there, that ambulance didn't just ride up after the, you know, spontaneous shooting, the thing that no one could have anticipated. The ambulance was parked there, Eddie. It was parked there, and then they didn't move after they killed him in this open field where he had no place to run and no place to hide. You would think that they would, you know, immediately rush his bleeding body into the ambulance to go to the Parkland or Mineral Area Hospital, and they left him on the ground from 2:00 in the morning. This was in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. They left him in the ground from the time they killed him at 2:00 in the morning until 6:00 in the morning, till sunup. I mean, we're talking, you know.
Was he dead at 2:00 in the morning?
They left him to bleed to death, Ed. I don't know the exact moment that he died. They've pumped him full of bullets from all angles. You know that's going to come out in the Associated Press story that I told you, you know, that reporter is doing. He got the coroner's report. He knows the situation of the body now. This is all coming out, Ed. You know, and depending on how he writes it, if he writes it in a, you know, if he's going to write it in an inflammatory way, you know, are we going to kind of lose control of this thing? Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen on Wednesday. In other words, we are taking this huge leap of faith. We are making Black history. And so Saturday night.
We're straying from the point, Francis. You said they left him to bleed to death.
Yes.
There's the suggestion here that he was executed. And yet you also say that you're counting on this AP reporter to look at the facts. I mean, from a journalistic standpoint, I totally hear everything you're saying, that Black Americans are constantly I see it in this neighborhood. There is an ongoing oppression.
Tell me.
Well, but the point I'm trying to make here is you better have your facts straight before you make allegations. That's the first rule of journalism. And if you don't have all the facts and you're only getting hearsay or conjecture from various sources, however sympathetic you may feel, you have to make sure that the story is right. And so
I would like to suggest something to you. I am a fiction writer. I am a literary artist. I am interested in composition. I'm interested in increasing thought. And I am interested in creating counter narratives, persuasive, you know, rhetorically persuasive counter narratives, in some sense, a merchant of doubt. I want to ask you why you, you know, in the face of all evidence, and you just look around you, the kind of world that you live in, that is propped up by, you know, the corporate media and the racist ethos that is at the core of, you know, major newspapers in major urban centers. Why do you take what they say at face value? Why do you take what the police say at face value? Why don't you spend your time interrogating whether the official narrative stands up to scrutiny? Why focus on my little imaginative, rhetorical narrative powers?
because
I am suggesting an alternative to the official narrative that in our guts we know stinks.
But don't you fall into the exact same trap as the official narrative if you don't actually listen to the other side? I mean, I got Lieutenant Pike on the phone, the cop who went ahead and sprayed the UC Davis kids. And that was one of the hardest calls I ever had to make because subjectively, in my bones, I was against the guy. Objectively, however, I had to hear his side of the story because you have to hear every single person's perspective, whether you like them or not. So when you create a counter-narrative, it's counter-reality sometimes.
Darling, you're a journalist. I do not define myself as a journalist. I define myself, you know, as a literary artist, and I guess an activist, though I wish that category didn't even exist. I wish that there weren't, didn't need to be people who kind of devoted most of their energy to activism. I wish everybody would just do a little bit and we'd get there a whole lot faster and we'd have a whole lot more fun.
The great irony is that I don't define myself as much of a journalist either, although I am trying to get better. I started making calls around Farmington.
Chief Baker doesn't answer the phones here. This is Farmington Police.
I couldn't get in touch with Farmington Police Chief Rick Baker, but I did talk with Coroner Jim Copland.
So, my question to you, I looked at the Post-Dispatch story, and it basically indicated that there was an autopsy, and the details could not be released until the Highway Patrol had investigated. I was wondering if there are additional details now, a year later, that you could release. My understanding is that there are certain gunshot wounds. I was wondering if you can confirm this.
Yeah, there was. I'm going by memory now here, but I think there was 6 total gunshot wounds.
Do you know what the position of the gunshot wounds were?
Different positions, up from different angles.
My understanding is that the report indicates that the gunshot wounds were in the back. Is that true?
I believe most of them was from the back toward the front. Yes.
There weren't any in the front? They were all in the back, or do you know for sure?
Well, I think most of them was from the back going frontwards, not in the back itself, but like in the leg, one in the arm. I can't remember the rest without looking at my report, but there was some in the torso itself. But it's kind of scattered.
I also spoke with Brandy Hamblin, Callion's ex-wife. Callion had called Brandy shortly before the police arrived, asking her to pick him up at 1 a.m.
Why do you feel this was an execution, and what happened exactly here?
Well, I feel like it was an execution because it was, I feel like it was strategically planned. You know, several departments were involved. It happened at 2 o'clock in the morning, where there wasn't any witnesses per se. He was shot multiple times. He was on the run, as we would say, had jumped bond on a drug charge. So the bondsmen were looking for him. Yeah. And apparently there was an altercation when the bondsmen came to the place that he was. But when I say that, I mean their story is that a shot was fired. You know, insinuating that he fired a shot at them. I don't know if any of that's true at all, but that was the story. And then he ran from them, like in the middle of the night, this all happened. He was killed at like 2 a.m. So they ambushed him at night where he was staying, and he was running in February in the cold, dark night with no coat on. They tracked him by his cell phone, and like the police, sheriff's office, bondsmen were all on site where he was shot. It was literally like a parking lot full of police cars when he was shot down.
Yeah.
And so that's why I feel like it was excessive. Yes, he was wanted by the police or the bondsmen for jumping bond. It really, I guess, didn't have anything to do with the police at that point. But he had skipped bond, and that's why they were looking for him over a drug charge. He didn't kill anyone, shoot anyone, molest, rape, you know. it was a drug charge.
To be absolutely clear on this, my understanding is the bondsmen were after him, and they called the police, and that's when the police came in. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you say that this was excessive force on the part of the police department. The Post-Dispatch article says that Callion had pointed a gun at a deputy and was running towards him. What do you think about this? I mean, you know, how can we possibly know if there was a shot fired or not? I mean, all we have is the police's word, but what do you think happened here? Or, I mean, is it even appropriate to speculate?
Well, I don't think that happened at all. Not at all. I mean, Cal had been in the system for a long time, had dealt with the police off and on for petty little charges, and he was very smart. Very smart man. He would have never ran at the police with a weapon, ever. I mean, that's just not, I don't see that happening at all. And like you said, it's just their, I mean, it's their word, it's their story. We don't know, because it was in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. I don't know if there was a gun, you know. Also, there's evidence to show, which I don't know if I can talk about this now, but that he was actually running from them, or we would speculate that, by the gunshot wound that he did receive.
The coroner's report?
Right.
Yeah, okay. So here's a question for you. I mean, why didn't Callion turn himself in? I mean, that's probably the question that every other person looking at this story is going to ask herself. Why do you think that is? Why go on the run when he could have turned himself in? What was going on here?
Well, I mean, he had been in and out of jail, prison, many times. I mean, honestly, you know, 120 days here, 3 months there. You know, he did a couple of years one time. And he didn't want to go back, you know. But there at the end, the last few days, there's friends that talked to him that said, you know, he was going to turn himself in. Of course, he wasn't going to do that at 2 a.m.
So here we have Brandy. Her ex-husband has been shot by the police. She feels that it could be an execution, yet she's able to understand that Callion was a fugitive from justice. And she's also able to tell us why Callion did what he did. I challenged Francis on this idea of speculation being used in lieu of the facts. Speculation is a kind of rebel yell in lieu of journalism. And the conversation became quite heated.
But we're talking about speculation, hypothesis, based off of what we know, the facts. And it's the job...
I'm talking about using the brains that God gave us, Ed.
I understand that. But in terms of looking at any situation, you especially something this serious, where you're calling this an execution, where people die, where there's $20,000 on the line... This is where you have to exercise extraordinary due diligence, especially because you have, you have people who are recovering from this on all sides, by the way. And that's why I'm saying that, you know, I'm wondering why imagination is more of a cure for something this serious than a serious investigation into the facts, which I think we both agree.
Because, Ed, it's not about an investigation into the facts. It's about adopting a different kind of worldview. It's making the leap from Newtonian physics to Einsteinian physics. And, you know, the facts are the facts, but we're asking for a reorientation. We're saying, don't give the police in a police state the benefit of the doubt. Don't allow the police to position themselves militarily as adversaries of the population.
You believe that the Farmington Police Department is a police state?
They have Homeland Security dollars pouring into St. Francis County. That's the only federal money that Joanne Emerson brought home in the last Congress in her earmarks to St. Francis County. You go on Legistorm and, you know, check it out. It's Homeland Security dollars are coming in here. Okay, that's a reorientation.
So you believe that every police officer is bad?
I want to reframe the question. Because I really think that's a very unfair question of you to ask me, Ed, and I'm kind of offended that you asked me that question.
Well, when you're saying that the Farmington Police Department is a police state,
My feeling is that, well, I haven't talked to any of the Farmington Police Department. There is likely Homeland Security money running into the police department. But just because that money is running in, this does not necessarily make it entirely a police state, nor does it make every officer on there a evil person. Especially when we haven't talked to them. Now we're talking about demonizing something, and we're falling into the exact same problem here that that created this whole thing in the first place.
No, darling, we're not. When Callion was born in 1979, there were six penal institutions in Missouri. There are 22 now. 16 major prisons were built in Missouri in his lifetime. Okay? That's the context. Right? They make these mass, and oh, and Ed, it's like living next to concentration camps. It's like, I actually feel like what it would be to be a townswoman in Dachau, you know, and just having this monstrosity on the edge of town. It's huge wall of barbed wire. And then if you manage to get over that one, then another one. And high beams and concrete, and oh my God, it's just so chilling and so terrifying even just to drive by these institutions.
They're
right in the middle of town, and everybody works there. They're the major employer.
Yes, no, but
they
you
have to keep them full and brimming, and oh my God,
sure. You just hit on it, okay? When we started talking about how it's a police state, you went straight to describing the buildings. You went straight to describing the institution. You then started talking about the system, about how it employs people. And now we're talking about a police state because there are systematic things that create this condition. And that's why I'm saying you have to be very careful, because when you put people into any situation, certain kind of conditions are going to cause them to do terrible things. It's not necessarily that they're bad people. I mean, I've seen...
Ed, you know what? I'm a little bit sick of letting people off of that hook. You know, you vote with your feet, you vote with your life, you vote with your energy, you vote with your time. And so, yeah, at a certain point, you know, you can say, yes, it's systemic, but if you volunteer for that slot in that police force, knowing what we know now about what's coming, drones and microwave technologies and all the things that, you know, they're cooking up for us.
But they didn't know about...
It's pretty similar to joining a mercenary army at this point, you know?
Yes, but some of the police officers, let's say they joined 10 or 15 years ago. At that point, drones were hardly known. They certainly weren't in the public dialogue as they are today. I mean, you honestly believe that if people are, you know, in the middle of a career, that when something happens that they can't control, such as drones, that they're entirely responsible, they should be morally damned if they're still enmeshed in that system? What if they can change things from within the system? I mean...
That would be really good, Ed. I really wish that more people would change things from within the system. That would be really good. I'm with that. I'm down with that.
That's Pussy Riot performing Punk Prayer. On February 21st, 2012, one day after Callion Hamblin was shot in Missouri, this feminist punk rock collective performed this song at Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Savior to protest the Orthodox Church leader's support for Vladimir Putin during his re-election campaign. Three members of Pussy Riot were arrested weeks later and held without bail, kept in custody for many months on charges of hooliganism. Two of the three members were sentenced to 2 years in a penal colony, with this gross injustice attracting the notice and support from around the world.
Defense attorney, did you seek psychological or psychiatric help for your suffering?
I am an Orthodox believer. The healing energy of the Holy Ghost is a million times stronger than any psychologist. Did the healing energy of the Holy Ghost relieve your moral suffering then? Judge disallows the question.
Is feminist a swear word?
It is if it's said in church.
Those are contributors for a new book from the feminist press, Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer for Freedom. And they're reading excerpts from the Pussy Riot trial testimony before a packed audience on the night of the book's launch. I arranged a group discussion with many of the contributors to learn more about Pussy Riot's impact on the world at large.
Five girls dancing and singing something and making their own prayer at a church. How is it a problem? Like, eventually, after the video was released, after it all became such a big deal, it was just made to look like a problem by certain publicity mechanism of the state and the church, which are unfortunately very close and sometimes almost are the same thing in Russia.
So there has not been a blasphemy case since 1917. Why do you think Pussy Riot was the scapegoat in this case?
To me, it's pretty clear because it's the biggest protest. It's the biggest art performance of such a political significance for the last 20 years. So it's they like opened this old wound that was there growing and growing, and then finally they cut through it and all, you know, bad stuff, bad stinky stuff came out. That's exactly what happened.
Eileen, in your letter to Pussy Riot, you doubted the sincerity of Pussy Riot's punk prayer, and I was curious if you could elaborate on why you doubted the sincerity at first.
Well, I doubted it for a moment because I thought surely they jest. You know, surely they were in there to make a mess and give the church a hard time. And the more I listened to their statements in great detail, I understood that that kind of clarity, that kind of pinning their statement down wasn't possible, and that I had to take their statements as direct speech. You know, and perhaps that's what's most frightening of all, that you can mean different things inside of the same institution. You know, and that an institution is a living thing.
Did anybody else here have any doubts about the sincerity of Pussy Riot at any point? What were your feelings about this?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think in the United States, we're not used to radical feminists saying that they believe in God. And that's, you know, a question I asked Masha Gessen. I was like, do they really believe in God? Is this really just about the Putinist corruption of the church? Or do they, you know, because I personally, you know, object to the institution of, you know, of the patriarch and that entire religion on some level. I don't hold those beliefs. So, you know, in that way, there's a cultural difference between, you know, the feminism of my peers and theirs.
If you can't punish women, then where are you? I think it really kind of, you know, in the same way, I was just reading something lately that was talking about when they first realized that the earth was not the center of the universe. And people were burned as heretics, you know? And when I was reading what I was reading, they were explaining that they used to believe that there was a mantle over the earth and we were really protected and that we were inside. By living on the earth, we were inside of this known world. And to suddenly take that mantle off and for us all to be standing naked on a planet in the middle of a universe was totally scary, and it filled the medieval mind with fear. And what you had to do to stop that fear was burn people. And I think what we've, you know, in Russia to maintain the patriarchy, you've got to take these women and you've got to put them in jail or this thing is open suddenly. You know, and I think in the time, and if ACT UP had been put in federal prison for occupying St. Patrick's Cathedral, it would have been a very different moment. But I think at that moment, ACT UP was very savvy about the media, and so was the media in the U.S. And so they wouldn't push it that far because it would have obvious consequences.
And the girls weren't imprisoned. They weren't arrested until, you know, after the video of the performance went viral. So I think there was this kind of retaliation about this image going out to the world, and it really wasn't so much about punishing that particular action, but I think it was punishing the fact that there was so much velocity to that image. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. If Pussy Riot serves as an act of rebellion, is there any connection to Occupy Wall Street, or the Arab Spring, or the recent protests in New Delhi against the brutal suppression of women? I asked the group what they thought.
I mean, it's not a coincidence, obviously. It's parts of the same thing going on all over the globe, and it just represents, manifests itself differently. But I do totally think it's part of bigger structure and process.
It's part of the huge numbers of women in the streets in India in protest of those rapes. It's sort of like, I think it touches every woman and every man who thinks about issues like this.
And part of the thing is to not have to narrow it down to a single thesis statement that, you know, mm-hmm. it's contingent on the circumstances in each thing. And that's what they're, that's part of the whole thing is the toleration of ambiguity and flux and transformation in response to context. And that's part of what all of these movements are about.
In the case of Pussy Riot, performance was involved. But did the aesthetics of that performance lead to misperceptions on other fronts?
I think that one of the things, first, people had this suspicion that maybe the religion was tongue-in-cheek, and mm-hmm. the other thing that people have had a little bit of suspicion about was whether or not their artistry was kind of tongue-in-cheek. Like, are they just sort of putting on this punk thing as a kind of an act? And for me, actually, I think they're kind of related, and I think that there's sincerity in the art as well. And it's true that there might be a certain kind of strategic decision about certain aesthetic choices that they make, but I actually think they're pretty interesting on an artistic level. Like the choices that they made musically and in terms of the choreography. And earlier I was saying that when I talked to the defense lawyers, because they're so, the lawyers want to make it so clear that they're in jail because of their political position. So they keep saying it's a political protest, sometimes sort of not emphasizing the artistic aspect, but you know, and at one panel that I was at with some of the lawyers, that you know, one of them said, "Oh, you know, they had that ridiculous choreography," as though you know, just sort of like to toss uh-huh. it off. I thought that I'm a dance scholar, and I have this, you know, like deep interest in what's effective choreographically, and I thought that was one, it's like a super compelling performance as an artistic mm-hmm. event, partly because. Precisely of this question of the sincerity of the religiosity of the event, which for me also was related to the ACT UP action in mm-hmm. St. Patrick's Cathedral, because once again that if you lie down, if you have a die-in in a church, and if you believe, if there's an aspect of political belief, then you know obviously the aesthetic ramifications also are multiplied immensely. So that the sincerity, I think, of the prostration on the altar and all of that as a choreographic element was totally related to the sincerity of the politics, which is belief, you know? Mm-hmm. So all of those things for me, I found it as a performance, like really compelling.
If belief is part of what it takes to be a mover and a shaker, consider the case of Rosa Parks. The historians and the statesmen describe Rosa Parks as a meek seamstress who was tired and boarded a segregated bus after a long day of work on December 1st, 1955, and refused to give up her seat to a white passenger when asked and changed the course of civil rights. But historian Jean Theo Harris points out in her new book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, that Rosa Parks wasn't nearly as quiet as history has painted her.
Rosa Parks was very much aware that she was a symbol. Douglas Brinkley even describes her as this maternal figure for all the young guys. And I was fascinated by this because even when Parks appears on To Tell the Truth, two of the judges actually identify this more demure version of her, not her. So my question is, given how much she found talking about 1955 so tedious, why didn't she set the record straight? Was it because she was a shy and introverted person? Was it because her ethos, as you point out also in the book, had more to do with people finding out what they needed to know about being revolutionary, about understanding politics, understanding the world?
Well, I think two things. I think she is constantly trying to set the record straight and people don't hear her. Right, so there's all of these moments when she says, "No, I wasn't tired. I think that's kind of a joke. That's not true." She says this over and over, but people don't necessarily remember, listen, take that up. You mentioned the To Tell the Truth, so she's on To Tell the Truth again. For people who don't know, it's this game show where basically there's a panel of people who are trying to fool the judges that they are the real person, and then the real person is also taking part. So they do an episode that has three Rosa Parkses. You can see it on YouTube. And the judges, more of the judges pick someone who's not the real Rosa Parks because she, you know, she talks faster, she doesn't use as many details, she sort of embodies the symbol, not in some sense the real, actual Rosa Parks. But I think part of why Rosa Parks continues to be willing to be the symbol, right? She does thousands of programs, you know, school programs, church programs. I mean, she just, for years, you know, kind of shows up when people ask. And I think it's because she sees this as a way to keep the movement going, to keep the history alive in many ways, to keep the struggle alive. Now, that obviously is not always the way it gets taken, right? Yeah. But that, in many ways, is what she's trying to do. She's a race woman and sort of sees it as, in some sense, her responsibility to do all these things. But people don't always listen, right? And so what they hear is different than what she's saying sometimes.
Yeah. So you feel that the inability of academics and scholars and journalists and interviewers to look beyond 1955 to see that she actually had a history of activism beforehand, to ask her questions, that this is one of the reasons why it reinforced the symbol. I mean, even statesmen thought her to be a very sort of calm and demure type of person, the so-called seamstress who had enough, when in fact she was tired of being repressed, not tired of being on her feet all day.
Right.
That really, it's lack of curiosity, lack of proper inquiry?
I think some of it is not understanding. I mean, she is calm, she is demure, she is reserved. And yet she's also determined, feisty,
yeah.
Has this like kind of steely core. And I think sometimes people don't see that you can be reserved, you can be shy and still be, you know, have more radical politics, have more of a kind of feisty spirit to you.
Yeah.
And so I think some of it is this, we tend to have these dichotomies, these false dichotomies. Some of it is that symbol, you know, serves us well, I think, in the contemporary as a way to both honor the civil rights movement but put it in the past, right? If you see a kind of Parks who keeps going for four decades after the Montgomery bus boycott, see her in the North, see her working on issues like police brutality or poverty or the end of the war in Vietnam, right? This is a much more modern Rosa Parks, and it's a Rosa Parks that I think behooves on us to sort of keep working for change today. And that's not the Rosa Parks, I think, that in some sense serves sort of our national sort of mythology or, you know, kind of this kind of idea of a post-civil rights America.
But is it really Rosa Parks, or is it America's uncomfortable relationship with rebellion or revolutionary politics? I mean, you know, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panthers, Black Power, this all came later, and white America was very afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
But Rosa Parks, of course, fit the role of someone who they could accept. And I'm wondering if it has more to do with racial politics or more to do with revolutionary politics or our inability to really grapple with our history of rebellion.
Well, I mean, I think we have to remember how much Rosa Parks was seen as a troublemaker at the time. And she was red-baited, and she was red-baited in 1955, but she's red-baited in 65. When John Conyers hires
yes.
her to work in his Detroit office in 65, and it, you know, her name becomes public again, you know, they get tons of hate mail and hate calls, you know, basically saying, how could you hire this? And this is in Detroit. This is in the North, right? This is not, you know, Alabama 1955. And so she was not sort of acceptable. And in many ways, I think part of what's happened to Rosa Parks is what happened to Martin Luther King, right? There's all of this kind of, there's this movement to get a King holiday that has all this resistance to it. And then we get a King holiday. And then the King that gets honored in the holiday is a fuzzy, dreamy King. And I think this is similar to what's happened to Rosa Parks, that in some ways we've had all of these kind of national honors to her over the past two decades. But in some sense, she's become a fuzzy one too, right? And so all of the other things she did and kind of the core of her kind of political beliefs and the fact that those political beliefs were unacceptable at the time, right? By, you know, again, when she has them in 1955, that gets erased from the story, so that the fact that Rosa Parks was called un-American for two decades doesn't become part of the story as she's honored when, you know, when she dies, or obviously she gets a stamp last week, right? That the kind of, in many ways, the repression she faced for decades, you know, similar to the repression King faced, right, becomes, it's an unpleasant part of the story, and so it falls out of the story in some respects.
I was very surprised in reading your book to discover how Rosa Parks was not allowed to speak during very several key moments. Reverend Grates tells you during an interview that during the mass meetings for the Montgomery bus boycott, Parks was treated like she didn't have anything to say. She was never invited to speak at these meetings. Years later, you have E.D. Nixon. He's getting miffed because the NAACP wants Sister Rosa in Washington. And he says, "How about me, baby?" And they said, "No, we want Sister Rosa." Shortly after her arrest, during the Holt Street Baptist Church scenario, Parks wasn't invited to speak and told that she had said enough. So my question is, you know, why didn't Nixon or Martin Luther King or any of these others realize that Parks was such a momentous draw for audiences? Was this ego? Was this chauvinism? Was this a situation where Rosa Parks was considered to be this kind of maternal symbol, and the various movements of the time felt, well, she has to live up to that particular label?
I mean, I do think one of the things, one of the key reasons is gender, and that we see this in terms of the decisions about who will speak, who will be in the leadership, right? I mean, the Montgomery bus boycott is actually organized initially by the Women's
Yes.
Political Council, and yet Joanne Robinson, I mean, we don't see very many women in the leadership of the Montgomery Improvement Association. Obviously, we fast forward to 1963, the March on Washington, no women are get to speak at the March on Washington. Even when women protest, they decide, okay, we're not going to be too hard to pick just one woman. They can't even imagine that two or three or five women could speak. So they basically have a handful of women, including Rosa Parks, stand up and be recognized. But so I think this speaks to kind of assumptions about who are the speakers and who are the leaders that don't actually match what is happening in terms of these movements and how and who's in these movements and who's organizing these movements.
It was Camus who wrote that rebellion cannot exist without a strange form of love. And as we've learned this week, our relationship with rebels, whether hidden or overt or religious or obsessive, is a very strange love indeed. Let's not discount it. That's our show for this week. Tune in next week for episode 6, when we devote our attention to bullies. Until then, we encourage you to follow your ears. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. Our thanks to the people of Times Square, Francis Madison, Brandy Hamblin, Jim Coplin, the contributors to the Pussy Riot anthology, which includes feminist press editorial director Amy Shoulder, Zena Grubstein, producer for the documentary Pussy Riot, Punk Prayer, poet Eileen Miles, Lori Weeks, Johanna Faitman, Barbara Browning, and Elizabeth Koch, and of course, historian Jean Theo Harris. And don't forget to visit our website at followyourears.com for all our episodes. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Robbie the Rebel is now working at a Taco Bell in Hamilton, Ohio, but his days of rebellion aren't over.